Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 080074, Thomas O. Bennett and James B. Bonham Corporation versus Randy Reynolds from San Saba County and the Third Court of Appeals District. And then there are three cases that have been consolidated for argument, 080528, 080529, and 080534, involving the John G. Marie Stella Kennedy Memorial Foundation and Frost National Bank, former executor of the estate of Elena Suze Kennedy versus Ann M. Fernandez from Kennedy County and the 13th Court of Appeals District, and 080970 Scott and White Memorial Hospital and Scott Sherwood and Brindley Foundation versus Gary Fair and Linda Fair from Bell County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between them. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the court's arguments should be posted on the website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 080074, Thomas O. Bennett versus Randy Reynolds.
The court, Ms. Vance will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. The principal issue in this appeal is whether the act of selling $5,000 worth of stray cattle is sufficiently wanton and malicious to warrant punitive damages under the statute. Under this court's jurisprudence, it is not. We are asking the court to hold the line firmly drawn in Morial, reserving punitive damages for only the most extraordinary misconduct. Although we believe that the court can and should decide this case at the threshold, if punitive damages are warranted, there are two other additional issues. First, whether punitive damages can be imputed to the landowner corporation. And secondly, whether the $1.25 million in punitive damages, which is a 235-to-1 ratio, is constitutionally excessive in this case. As we've pointed out in our briefing, national commentators have commented on the aberrance of this award as an outlier. We believe allowing this case to stand completely destroys the line differentiating ordinary run-of-the-mill misconduct for which punitive damages are not warranted and extraordinarily heinous conduct for which punitive damages are intended.
Are you familiar with Cooper versus Leatherman?
Yes, sir.
That seems to be right on point with your issue here and trying to measure the punitive damages versus the actual award that was rendered here, which was less than $6,000. So that's the way I read the case. With that in mind, is it we send this back down for further consideration, or is there something we can resolve here?
Pardon me, Judge, I didn't hear the last part of your question.
With the Cooper v. Leatherman holding and the analysis that was applied there in actual damages versus punitive damages, I believe the Supreme Court sent that back down to the Ninth Circuit for analysis. Is that what we should do here, or is it something we can resolve?
Under this court's holding in Tony Gallo, the court has indicated that the proper procedure is to remand to the Court of Appeals to suggest a proper constitutionally acceptable award. And we believe that that's the appropriate procedure, also in line with what the United States Supreme Court has suggested is correct.
You'd agree that this is pretty reprehensible conduct. I mean, if you favor the jury's verdict, what sort of ratio do you think would be applicable? I mean, what happens when you have really reprehensible conduct that only produces economic harm?
Well, Judge O'Neill, we would not agree that truly reprehensible conduct is at issue here. What's at issue here is Mr. Bennett selling cows that were not his, and there is one very important issue that the parties both agree on and the Court of Appeals acknowledges, Mr. Bennett did not set out to steal or
well,
set...
Well, not to re-argue the evidence. I mean, if we presume, as the Court of Appeals seemed to find, that it was intentional cattle theft and witness tampering and potential even threats of witnesses, then, I mean, presuming that's true, it seems like the Court of Appeals looked at the fact that it could be thwarting the judicial system entirely, that sort of witness tampering and that sort of activity, and was particularly reprehensible. So just presume that that was true.
If all of those things were true, Judge O'Neill, there would still not be reprehensible conduct in this case that's punishable by punitive damages. The Court of Appeals made the mistake of considering conduct, dissimilar conduct, that was very far afield from the tortious conversion conduct that was at issue and for which Mr. Bennett was on trial in this case, in both its maliciousness analysis and reprehensibility analysis, which overlapped somewhat. And that is not permissible in the United States Supreme Court's jurisprudence nor this court's jurisprudence. There are two broad categories with some overlap that the Court of Appeals considered and certainly apparently affected the jury, which are litigation misconduct and what the Court of Appeals characterized as cover-up conduct. And to begin, as we've briefed the court, litigation misconduct is not correctly addressed or redressed by punitive damages. There are vehicles for that. There are sanctions and controls in place. None of them were invoked or implemented here.
Let me just be sure I understand on punitive damages. If I am I've got a ranch and there's a neighboring ranch, and if I were intentionally to go and steal cattle from my neighbor's ranch and sell it and profit from it, and the jury finds that to be so, you're saying that is not a case in which punitive damages would be recoverable?
Well, Chief, that conduct certainly constitutes theft and should be punished criminally. In this case, we know that Mr. Bennett was criminally acquitted for this activity.
No, but I'm just saying, just assume my facts, that I intentionally go and steal cattle and sell it, whether I'm prosecuted criminally or not. If a jury found that I had that intent and went and stole that cattle and sold it for profit, you're saying that is not a case in which punitive damages would be recoverable if found by a jury?
I think the answer to that is possibly, if there were other conduct involved. This court's standard for punitive damages, at warranting punitive damages at all, are either a specific intent to substantially harm the claimant or an extreme degree of risk. Malice and gross negligence.
But if that were the only conduct involved in the case, I steal intentionally my neighbor's cattle and sell it for profit, is that a case for punitive damages if a jury found that?
If that were all, I think no, because it's an economic harm that can be economically compensated. There's no death or injury involved. There's no financial ruin involved. Of course, there are other factors to consider. Certainly the position of the parties, whether they were financially vulnerable, if stealing the entire herd was going to bankrupt the neighbor, then that might be another consideration.
Punitive damages meant to punish this type of conduct?
The purpose of punitive damages are meant to punish to a degree and deter.
So how do we dissuade someone from stealing cattle in the future? I think they used to hang people here in Texas for doing that. So what's wrong with some punitive damages?
That's absolutely correct, and clearly livestock is an interest that's near and dear to the heart of Texans. But there are criminal penalties for that, which are assessed only after trial and conviction with the proper procedural safeguards in place.
Well, counsel, the jury found that defendant Bennett committed theft, unlawfully appropriated property with the intent to deprive. The jury found by clear and convincing evidence that conduct was attended with by malice and that it was conversion. Still no basis for punitives just on those three findings if they stand?
We would still say no.
And for this theft and conversion.
We would still say no for this reason, that Mr. Bennett was criminally acquitted for this conduct, that the $5,000+ that were awarded to Mr. Reynolds fully compensated him for the economic only harm. There was no threat to the general public. There was no threat to Mr. Reynolds' safety, and this is just not that type of misconduct that this court, the United States Supreme Court, reserves for substantial or even any punitive award.
Counsel, in the context of ranchers and often when their livelihood depends on their livestock and selling that, and considering the fact that there were apparently some misrepresentations in the beginning about whether or not he had taken the cattle, if you presume that some punitives are appropriate and you back out the litigation misconduct that you contend is not an appropriate component of that award, what is a ratio, assuming that punitive damages were appropriate?
Judge Guzman, we've had a little bit of difficulty. Of course, the United States Supreme Court suggests that we need to compare these punitive penalties to other comparable civil penalties or awards in other cases. We find no directly comparable civil penalty. There is a provision in the code for fine to a corporation that is found criminally culpable, and of course you cannot imprison a corporation. So if theft of a corporation is at issue, the maximum fine there is $20,000. We have found a case that we have cited here, Cass versus Stevens, which was reduced from a 25, it's a conversion case, reduced from a 25-1 to 3-1 ratio on remand from the Supreme Court.
But criminal culpability is not necessary to assess punitive damages.
That's correct, Judge Medina. The enumerated list are all penal code violations, so the majority of them are. So criminal conduct is a cap exempting requirement.
Well, I mean, there's also imprisonment, and I think cattle theft was punishable by, wasn't it 10 years in prison up to, and the fine. So how do you put a value on the time in prison?
Judge O'Neill, that's exactly why the United States Supreme Court says that's an improper comparator in awarding punitive damages. You cannot. And that's why they have reinforced that civil penalties are the appropriate comparator. And that is the overarching mistake that the Court of Appeals made, and that really infected this case, was comparing the appropriate amount of punitive damages to a prison sentence that for conduct that Mr. Bennett was acquitted for. And further than that, it was ramped up by Mr. Reynolds suggesting that a 10-year prison sentence for Mr. Bennett was equivalent to a life sentence. The language in the Mr. Reynolds' response to the motion for remittitor states exactly expressly that this is the last hope for the court to assess punishment for the criminal conduct that Mr. Bennett escaped. And punitive damages cannot be used in place of the criminal process.
Ms. Vance, I want to give you an opportunity to explain why the liability findings against the corporation under alter ego theories or agency principles is inappropriate in this case. Was there really a difference between Bennett and the corporation? Were corporate formalities kept? It seems to me the jury heard evidence that they were not.
That's correct, Chief, and it doesn't matter. Even if, as the jury found, the Mr. Bennett and the corporation were as one, the doctrine of disregarding the corporate entity is for the purpose of ensuring that the corporation is not used as an inequitable shield for assets either in front of or behind an individual defendant. So even a finding that Mr. Bennett and the corporation are one and the same does not warrant imputing liability to the corporation here. The corporation was formed many years ago. It was not formed for the purposes of hiding assets that were part of this judgment. It was not formed to perpetrate a sham on Mr. Reynolds. And if you look at all of the cases that we have cited where either the corporation
What does the record show about the purpose of the corporation?
The purpose of the corporation was to develop property. It was a property holding corporation held by Mr. Bennett's daughters. Mr. Bennett was the president, CEO. He was allowed to run cattle and live on the corporation, and he transacted business for the corporation.
Corporation owned the equipment that was used for cattle. They owned the fences, they owned the cattle guards. they paid employees who ran the cattle on the property. I mean, what is the corporation's argument that running the cattle was not in the interest of the corporation or the scope of Bennett's employment as president of the corporation?
Well, there's no evidence whatsoever that the corporation benefited in any way from the running of the cattle. The fact that they owned the equipment or the land was not material to this inquiry. It was absolutely undisputed that they owned no cattle and were not in the cattle business. But further than that, Judge Willett, even showing that an agent is acting for a corporation or even is the corporation, it still must be shown that the underlying misconduct was in the scope of employment. And although the Court of Appeals invented this cow policing idea to make it appear that Mr. Bennett was in the scope of the corporation's business by keeping trespassing cattle off the property, there was no evidence of that whatsoever. There's no nexus shown between the actions underlying this lawsuit and Mr. Bennett's responsibilities for the corporation.
Was Mr. Bennett a vice principal of the corporation?
There was no jury finding on that, Judge, but there was the disjunctive question of the four mechanisms by which liability could be imputed, one of which was vice principal. I don't think that it was necessarily argued below that the vice principal finding was wrongfully omitted, but even inferring, if we may, that he was a vice principal, it's still not enough. Just because he was a vice principal, that doesn't mean that all acts or all misconduct is directly imputed to the corporation. You still must show a nexus between the conduct at issue and the corporation's business.
You said you don't know if that was necessarily argued below. Was it or was it not?
It was not directly preserved, and it was not addressed by the Court of Appeals.
Was it preserved or not? I'm not sure what you mean by directly preserved.
I see that I'm out of time. May I continue? The motion for new trial and the briefing in the Court of Appeals was not a model of clarity. There were references to the incorrectness of charging the jury on corporate liability, but they were fairly broad.
Yes or no?
I'd have to say no.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Vance. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Keltner will present argument for the respondents.
If it please the court, the malice argument made by the petitioner is predicated on the idea that Moriel says to have malice, you have to have grievous physical injury, financial ruin, or death. That is not what Moriel says. All those words are in Moriel. Justice Cornyn was speaking to the difference between bad faith damages, which had been confused with punitive damages, and here's what he says. Would ordinarily result in extraordinary harm not ordinarily associated with breach of contract or bad faith denial of a claim, such as death, grievous physical injury, or financial ruin. Now, it could be other things because he used the word such as. Interestingly, the statute is what we have to apply. Chapter 41, which was in existence at that time, does not use the term grievous bodily injury, financial ruin, or death. It uses the term substantial injury, and it uses the term potential harm. That's exactly what was submitted here.
Mr. Keltner, though, when we have the type of ratio that we have at issue here, and looking prospectively at other cases, when you're pushing the damages to their constitutional limit in a case like this, what does that do to our review of other cases where you have this type of ratio?
Oh, Your Honor, we agree that the issue in ratio has got to be something that concerns the court. And when you see this ratio, it was obviously something the court wanted to look at. I would tell you that I think there are two things that the court must review in that regard to make sure that it doesn't have an impact on other cases. First off, remember there are two constitutional issues here. One, and the one on the three guideposts that we have in Gore, was determined by the United States Supreme Court to be a fair notice requirement. And that was what the court was looking at. Later, in the case Cooper Industries that Justice Medina talked about, we discussed the constitutional taking as well. Let's talk about the fair notice. Is there fair notice here? Yes. There in this statute, look at the notice that is provision that is provided. In the statute itself, it says the gloves are off if you commit something that the jury finds to be a criminal offense. So the notice provision, in one respect, is taken care of. But still, the ratio is one about is this just too high a ratio for constitutional concerns? Is it unusual punishment? As you know, Scalia and Thomas would say no. But the truth of the matter is this. When you look at this and consider the potential harm, and we have a significant disagreement with our friends on the petitioner side about this, the potential harm indicates the grounds from which you can judge the ratio. And let me tell you, I think the petitioner makes two mistakes here that are terribly important about, one, this charge, and two, the facts in this case. There wasn't just one conversion here. There were a series of acts. And if the court will look at question two, you will see it is not tied to the original taking of the cattle. It is tied to what conversion generally is. No objection that the charge didn't appropriately charge conversion. And let me tell you what they were. First, it was boxing up the cattle or trailering the cattle and sending them. Second thing, let's take Mr. Bennett at his word. Mr. Bennett says, look, I intended to send those off, but if it was determined that those weren't my cattle, don't know who was going to determine it, but if it was determined it wasn't, and he was going to have the money and, quote, make it right, return the money. He testified to that over a dozen times in this trial. What happens? The evidence is undisputed that when Randy Reynolds brings up the issue of his missing cattle at the courthouse after the trial over the defense, what happens? Mr. Bennett accuses Mr. Reynolds of stealing his cattle.
Was that over in an afternoon? I haven't looked at the record, but it looked like from the briefs that was all over in an afternoon. Each one of them took a deputy with him, and they drove out to each one of them's ranches, and they looked around, and nothing was found.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I would argue that it goes further and there's more conversion, but that's right. That issue was over relatively quickly, and the record is exactly as you suspect it to be.
There's a talk about threat of criminal prosecution against Reynolds, but the threat was that afternoon.
No, sir. And let me explain why. And you raise a good question, though. The threat was directly made at that period of time. It continued. After that, in a period of months, Mr. Bennett did several other things. The next thing he did was go out and get witnesses, and he offered to pay them to help prove that Reynolds had stolen the cattle.
Come up with evidence, right?
Sir?
To come up with evidence?
Yes, sir.
Well, what's the difference between that and hiring a private investigator?
In one respect, not a whole lot, but this was a fact witness to give testimony about it.
But he testified he was just supposed to give up any evidence that he had, and he didn't have any, and he didn't take the money.
That's right. That's right. But I think the jury could draw an inference from that issue as well. There was more that related to the criminal trial as well.
But if you hired a private investigator, he would take the money.
Yes, sir.
Even though he found nothing.
This fellow
didn't have anything, and he didn't take the money.
True enough. I think, though, that when you deal with somebody, not a private investigator, trying to find out the facts of the case and have someone come in and testify, and Mr. Bennett on cross-examination testifies what he intended to do. He wasn't getting money for nothing. It was only if the man would testify and Mr. Reynolds was actually convicted. Different than what a private detective could ever do under the statutes that guide them. You're not entitled to get paid that way.
Well, but people give rewards all the time for information leading to the arrest and conviction of X.
True enough. But there's more.
Okay.
There is more.
There's a lot more.
And the next thing that happens is their intimidation of witnesses happens in the criminal trial.
I have a question before you move on that other issue.
Yes.
Is that litigation misconduct, though, as characterized by opposing counsel, and not something that we would look at when we are looking at reprehensibility of this conduct?
No. It didn't have anything to do with this litigation. It had only to do with the criminal trial and putting Mr. Reynolds in jail. It is a completely different issue, as is the rest of the things, like changing the brand. When he learned that the Texas Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association had pictures that Mr. Grant had taken, he attempted to change the brand at the courthouse and make it his own brand, fortunately refused by the county clerk. Additionally, you had issues on where threats were made about people testifying. Mr. Grant explicitly, before this lawsuit is filed, is told, deny it all to the end. 9 times out of 10, we'll get off.
But that does that go to how reprehensible this conduct is, or is that discovery abuse, litigation misconduct, for which punitive damages are not assessed?
I think it goes to two things. I think one, it goes to the issue of malice and what he knew and what intent was, because at the same time, he was still converting the property. Remember, at the time that he gets the pictures that Ranger Andrews from the Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association shows him, he's got the pictures showing them that they have Reynolds brand. He's still holding the $5,300 that he said, I'm going to make it right and give it back. Does he continue to convert it, or does he give it?
Can you convert money?
Yes.
Okay, so he sold the cattle and he kept the money, so till the end of his life he's still converting, and
yes,
then
sir,
he can be punished for anything bad that he does to the other party while he's holding that money, then is your position?
I think I would not take it that far. I would say that if you are continuing to converting, and remember, this is his defense. His issue is, I didn't convert when I took it because I was going to give the money back if I determined they weren't mine, or I learned they weren't. During that period of time, yes, I think we can hold him liable for the other things he did. Remember, in a criminal enterprise, especially in an issue like this, where there is cattle theft and it's not a murder crime or kidnapping or something like that, the key is to get away with it. You got to hide your tracks. You got to cover your tracks of what you've done. It's the only way you come out. The criminal enterprise isn't completed until the end of the situation. That's what they want you to ignore. TXO, the Supreme Court considered this very thing. They have suggested to you in their opening brief that TXO was no longer good law. We disagree. In BMW versus Gore, TXO is cited 13 times, written by the same justice. In every case regarding punitive damage that is significant, say Cooper Industries, which doesn't deal with an issue that TXO was dealing with, TXO is cited with approval. And here's what it says, and remember, it's directly on point to what we have here. There, the issue was slander against title. You know the facts, but here's basically what they were. What had happened is there had been a lease given, taken by TXO. TXO subsequently learned that they might have an argument that the lease is no good and they could get out of it and maybe renegotiate the royalty. They had what was termed a phenomenal royalty of 22%. To do that, they took a position that actually the mineral title had been conveyed away from the donor previously. The court found that to be baloney. And in fact, in a matter of contract construction, that wasn't true. Here are the things that were submitted to the jury. It was only slander of title. The only damages you could get under slander of title at that period of time was the amount of attorney's fees to defend the title. And that's what they got, $19,000. And the issue was, okay, are we going to judge the $10 million award, punitive award, against those $19,000? And if we do, certainly it has constitutional problems. Or do we look at the potential harm? And in TXO, they looked at the potential harm. And in fact, according to the dissenting justices, they looked at it just from evidence in the record and calculated it to be between $5 and $8 million that could have happened to whom? Plaintiff. And that's the important thing. And they said, so that is a ratio of 1 to 2, and they sustain that issue. This case is exactly the same. TXO, although the court has been invited on 4 times to change TXO, the Supreme Court has not done that, and they have considered potential harm, again, to whom? to the plaintiff. That is the crucial issue.
But it looks to me, just following that along, because I think we do have to deal with that, that the complaint here is that there was a threat of criminal prosecution against Reynolds, which was investigated in a few hours and was over. There was an offer to Hibbler to produce evidence, which he didn't have, and he didn't take the money. There was some talk about threats against people, which never happened, and some talk about trying to get people to change their testimony, which never happened. So how does that, what is the, how do we assess the potential harm in that?
Here's, I think you do it the same way that the United States Supreme Court did in TXO. You determine if the scheme had been successful, what would the damage to the plaintiff be? And that's what they did. In TXO, just like here, it was not possible to recover anything more in a slander of title case than the attorney's fees. Here, it was only possible to recover one thing in a conversion case, and that is the value of the title. But the damage, I'm sorry.
But here, if he had suborned perjury, physically assaulted witnesses, bribed Hibbler, and maliciously prosecuted Reynolds, the sky would be the limit, I would think.
I agree. I think the damage.
If none of those things did happen, then how do we discount it?
Well, Your Honor, it is if the scheme worked. That's what TXO decided, and BMW confirms as well. That is, it is if the scheme worked, it played out, you look at the likely harm to the plaintiff. I will admit that the other side has a point in what they talk about in the Philip Morris case regarding the harm to other people. Same issue was true in Campbell, where the United States Supreme Court found that Utah Supreme Court had given extraterritorial effect to other conduct and conduct happening between the defendant and other people. In Philip Morris, the same was true. And the Supreme Court cautioned, hey, let's not do that. You can't do that. That's not fair. You got to consider only the potential harm to the plaintiff. That's what the jury did here, we believe, in assessing punitive damages. Justice Pemberton, in his opinion, says precisely that, and we think that is entirely appropriate.
So when did the conversion occur?
It happened over a period of time. First conversion.
So when did the cause of action accrue for conversion?
Your Honor, the cause of action would have, I think, accrued originally when the cattle were trailered up and taken to the Jordan auction in San Saba. I think it continued to occur, though, when the jury could have believed that or could have not believed that. They could have believed under this charge in question two, which wasn't limited in that period of time, that the conversion occurred when Mr. Bennett learned that the cattle were actually not his, and there was convincing evidence of that.
When did that occur?
It happened at least three times. It happened once originally when they trailered the cattle. Second time when Reynolds tells him, I think either my cattle are on your place. He certainly had reason to believe it. The third time it happened, and it's hard to deny, when the Texas Southwestern Cattle Ranger, Association ranger goes to the sheriff and has pictures of the brands and is able to check him with the Jordan cattle auction to say, yeah, and through previous sales and the like, those were Reynolds' cattle, and okay. He still kept the money.
Let me ask you about that. Those were Bennett's cattle, and it doesn't seem to be disputed that the cattle operation was Bennett's personally and not the corporation's.
Your Honor, I don't want to make too big a point of this because the majority of the evidence is certainly that way. It is disputed, though, and there are several things that happen in this case. In the fence litigation, Bennett claimed that he had title to the ranch itself and the cattle operation was his. So that would mean that all of them were the corporation's cattle. But he testified later, and we don't have any evidence to dispute it, that the cattle actually belonged to him. They certainly were sold on his account, but they were rounded up, put it by corporation employees, put in a trailer by corporation employees.
But does that really matter? I mean, when we look at, I mean, let's say he was a vice principal, but he has to have still sold them in furtherance of the corporate purpose. And it's to me, the Court of Appeals opinion is very weak on that point, that the corporate purpose is to keep other cattle out of the corporate property. But that doesn't then translate into I can sell the cattle and it becomes the corporation's money.
Your Honor is correct. And the truth of the matter is, when you look at that one part, remember what the Court of Appeals was looking at. They did not consider the alter ego theory at all, as you know. That was something that they did not write on. They didn't address that particular issue, but they decided it on an agency theory. And the way agency was charged in this case was for all of the actions. And there is no error preserved as to that. None at all. The objection there is it is, quote, a misstatement of the law, or there's no evidence to support it.
You make this conversion analysis seem to be like an insurance analysis on when an event occurs, and in the words of the Honorable Justice Ouellette, it seems like it occurs when it happens, not when someone happens upon it. And so how can there be three different conversions? And is there just one act that we have to look to?
No, sir, and let me tell you why. In this case, it is important, this is a factually intense case, and the facts make this case very unusual. The truth of the matter is Bennett's defense raised this issue, and that's why the charge had to be brought. He said, I didn't convert when I took those cattle. I didn't convert at all because it was my intention to give the money back. Well, take him at his word, and the jury well could have. There were three other occasions in which he had direct evidence that the cattle weren't his and he didn't return the money.
What do you think would be an excessive award?
You don't want to bet against himself.
More than $1 million, Your Honor. Mm. You expected me to say this. Here's what I would say. This is obviously the court, just as in Tony Gullo, has to look at the amount of the award regardless of the waiver of the cap. We have struggled with this idea. I think that an award significantly above what we had would be problematic. I know that this amount has to concern the court. And I know you have to do your job in looking at the ratio to show that the state of Texas is serious in enforcing the United States Constitution. In looking at that, it is hard to say, but for intentional criminal conduct on evidence they no longer dispute, looking at the potential harm, and remember, the evidence of the potential harm came, one, from a 2-year minimum to a 10-year maximum of possibility of harm, and also from Mr. Bennett himself, who testified, remember, in his malicious prosecution counterclaim that the value of the award and the harm would have been done for putting him in jail under the same statute.
Wouldn't he have a malicious prosecution claim for that?
Do we?
Sure.
No, ma'am. And they point that out to you. That's their argument. They argue,
if there's a remedy, if there's a cause of action that would remedy it, do we subsume that within a punitive damages award?
Your Honor, I think the answer to that, I'm going to come at it another way and answer indirectly. I think the answer to your question is you have to look to see if the scheme and likely harm, what that would be, and that applies to the amount that the ratio applies to. So in answer to Justice Heck's question, if the ratio is applied and a 2-to-1 or 1-to-1 is applied per defendant, I think that would be appropriate in this case.
But I guess what my question is, if we were looking at a malicious prosecution claim,
yes,
and that would include the potential harm from the malicious prosecution, it doesn't seem to me the evidence would support this kind of an award for malicious prosecution. And if that's the case, why would it support a punitive damages award of this amount?
Let me explain, I think, why. First off, in this case, it wouldn't, because remember, there wasn't a prosecution in this case. So the issue there is, we couldn't bring a malicious prosecution claim as a result of that. The issue is, when you're dealing with malicious conduct, no matter the cause of action, just like in TXO, remember, slander of title, all they could get under TXO was the attorney's fees. Did the court consider that? No, they looked at a breach of contract that did not occur, or the court didn't let occur, to be able to calculate the harm upon which the ratio was calculated.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Bell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to begin where Mr. Keltner began and left off with TXO, certainly.
First of all, let me ask you, did you waive an agency theory?
I beg your pardon?
I understood that the jury found one of the basis for the jury findings of corporate liability would be that he was acting as an agent of the corporation. And has that argument been waived here, that he was not an agent of the corporation in selling the cattle?
I think even if it has, Justice O'Neill, it doesn't matter because, again, there's no nexus shown. I don't think the court necessarily needs to decide that. The court could address that without deciding that issue. I think it was perhaps arguably not preserved. I will point out that there was vehement objection, both in the motion for a new trial and below, that the jury was improperly charged altogether on corporate liability. TXO, clearly the seminal potential harm case, but this is not a potential harm case. There was no scheme alleged to do anything to Mr. Reynolds. As we pointed out earlier, the parties agree that Mr. Bennett did not set out to steal his cows. He did not plot to steal the rest of the herd. He did not plot to entice other cows to wander up onto the ranch. There was a single finite act of selling cows that were on his property.
So when do you say the conversion occurred?
The conversion occurred when Mr. Bennett put the cattle into the trailer and trucked them off to be sold.
Not when he kept the money and cattle raisers investigators came to him. That's not the conversion under your view.
Justice Johnson, to me, that points out one of the most disturbingly broad characteristics of the rule that our opponents propose, which is that if you do not lay down in litigation and concede that the other side is correct, that you will be subject to a 235-1 potential punitive damage award. I think that this court's decision has to be informed by policy and what are we trying to deter. If that's the rule, then every time a litigant loses, if they didn't concede at the moment that they were shown some evidence that their position may be wrong, they'd be subject to an enormous punitive damages award. That's an inappropriate use of punitive damages. The conversion occurred when it did, which was in October of 2000. And I would point out, just while we're on that topic, that the report of the mutually missing cattle was about a month after that. The discovery by Mr. Reynolds that perhaps the cattle that had been sold in October of 2000 and the revelation of those photos and so forth to Mr. Bennett didn't happen for another year. So that criminal report was a dust-up in the afternoon. Clearly there are hard feelings on both sides of this, but it was over. There was no criminal prosecution. The system worked, and that was it. That's the trouble with the TXO analysis here. There was no scheme. And the input for potential harm is the theoretical harm that would have happened to Mr. Reynolds if that report to law enforcement had resulted in a wrongful conviction, and the measure of that harm is based on what Mr. Bennett thought was a fair award to him for his mental anguish damages, which Mr. Reynolds also did not plead or prove.
It is pretty serious and egregious to accuse someone of a crime you know they didn't commit and to ruin their reputation, so to speak. That's especially in a ranching community where stealing cattle is a pretty serious offense.
I would certainly agree with that, Justice Guzman. And in fact, Mr. Bennett's counterclaims were based on exactly that in this suit. Now, the jury did not find for him, but it was not a meritless claim. The motion for directed verdict on his claim was denied, and it was allowed to go to the jury. And so certainly, yes, that's true. But there was no evidence that this was a frivolous complaint. Not go past that. Mr. Bennett made that complaint based on the same source of information that Mr. Reynolds had about missing cows, which was Larry Grant, who's basically the spider in the middle of this web. The TXO potential harm was a scheme. There was a quiet title on an ill-gotten quitclaim deed, and if they had succeeded, the damage would have been huge. But I would point out that TXO certainly predates the refinements made in State Farm and Gore, and the Supreme Court has shown an ever-increasing or ever-decreasing tolerance for large ratios of this kind. But again, the two critical mistakes there are inputting potential harm to Reynolds on a theoretical threat and valuing that based on what Mr. Bennett thought his claims were worth. I wanted to just briefly touch on, and I see I just only have a moment, that cover-up should be, that inquiry should be directed to the hazard imposed by the underlying conduct. There was no hazard here that more cow selling was going to occur or harm anyone. And that may go to intent, but we're content is not, intent is not before the court. We're not contesting that here. And the hugely broad amount of conduct that has been brought in to put the finger on the scale for both malice and reprehensibility does not comport with the Supreme Court's punitive damage jurisprudence, nor this court's. It's not intended to be a catalog of the entire relationship between Mr. Bennett and Mr. Reynolds. A serious line drawing needs to be done. How far back do we go? How far forward do we go? How far afield do we go? And the answer is, it's the conduct that underlies the lawsuit. That's all that was charged here. It's all that was pleaded. It's all that was proven. All of the other evidence that was here was dissimilar conduct. It was not before the court. It was not pleaded or proven. As the litigation misconduct has other remedies, as the court recognizes, this was an inappropriate vehicle to try to punish those wrongs. I see that I've exceeded my time. Are there other questions?
Thank you, Ms. Vance. Are there any questions? Then the cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.